Podcasting worldwide from Vancouver, Canada. Welcome back to the Personal Process Podcast. The show that takes you through the growth, hardship, self-discovery, lessons, and stories of individuals who achieved success in their own personal path. Trust the process.
Welcome back to the Personal Process Podcast. Today, we are very excited to have Chris Resto here. Who is Chris Resto? Well, he is an MIT-trained civil engineer turned into a very amazing author. He's also the owner of the Blueprint Talent Group. And, you know, his story in changing from a civil engineering company and, you know, prospect in this regard to what he's done now is very interesting for me. We had a very awesome chat right before our interview today. So I got to know him a little bit. We're both into fitness and we both showed each other. Well, I didn't show mine, but Chris showed me his home gym. And for those of you who are into fitness, he has an amazing setup. With that said, Chris, is there anything that I missed in my introduction? And how are you doing today, sir?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me, Parham. Good to be here.
Right on, right on. So, Chris, I want to ask you, how does someone graduate from MIT's engineering program and say, maybe I will go into the recruiting industry and teach individuals how to recruit their top prospects? That's a very interesting transition for me.
Well, it's a bit of a story, and I know you like stories here on the podcast. So interrupt me, please. I mean, because very few people go into the recruiting business having that in mind, right? I actually think it starts with my time at MIT, where I did civil engineering. Most of my friends and more the majors you think about when you think of MIT: electrical engineering, computer science, physics. And I didn't realize until now, being in my 40s, that the training of being a recruiter and doing talent management started while all my friends were writing problem sets and I was kind of the person providing emotional support and making connections and being the social chair at my MIT fraternity. I, without knowing it, was when this was all happening in the background. But I didn't know what I wanted to do when I graduated from MIT. I did a couple internships at Xerox and Roman Haas Chemical Company, enjoyed them, but knew that was not my calling. So I actually took the time to do a summer program and serve as a TA for a summer program that I had participated in while I was in high school at MIT. And through that, knew I had some interest in education, but still didn't know what I wanted to do. So I did management consulting, which is what a lot of people do from MIT who don't know what they want to do, especially back in the late 90s. And so I chose to go to Gemini Consulting, which was a European strategy and operations consulting firm. I took that job largely because I knew I was going to be able to travel outside the US, which nice. I really hadn't yet, besides a short trip to Canada when I was in the sixth grade. And so here I took this job because consulting was a good way to learn about business. It was a good way to learn about methods and tools to analyze businesses and to learn about different industries. And so I did that for a couple years. And while I was in my second year, the person who I had worked for at that MIT summer program my junior year called me and said, "The entrepreneurship class that you served as a TA in our summer program, we just lost the instructor because he got his Series A round of funding to start his company. And he can't give up 2 weeks to teach a high school class to high school juniors." And he said, "Can you do it?" And I said, "Well, I kind of have a job." this was circa 2000, 2001, when business was slow because the dot-com boom was kind of becoming the dot-com bust. And so I essentially went to the director, my manager, and said, "Can I go teach this class at MIT, a class that I TA'd for while in college?" He said, "You know what? Things are a little slow. That'd be great. We're totally supportive of you doing it." So I went back, taught this class, and re-engaged with the MIT Dean of Engineering, who noticed me engaging with students and said, "Looks like you really like engaging with students and teaching. We want to start a program to help develop leaders out of our students. And at the time, you don't think of engineering, education, and leadership in the same sentence. It was leadership was for the business school, engineering and differential equations and design was for the engineering school. And here you had, you know, the dean of the engineering school, actually the two deans, the associate dean and the dean, two professors who I think were very cutting edge in their thinking, who wanted to expose students to career planning, to developing professional skills, and to leadership. And so they said, we want someone to serve as the founding director. Why don't you come do it? And I said, nope. In my Palm Pilot, it says I'm supposed to apply to business school at the end of my second year of consulting, and that's what I'm going to do, because that's what everyone else is doing. And they were like, no, like, you should really come back and do this. Like, this is going to make you a better candidate for business school. And that was kind of their hook, so to speak. And after months of going back and forth and having informal conversation and me getting counsel from my family and my friends, I decided to make the leap and leave consulting and go back to MIT a second time to start this professional development program for sophomores. And so, you know, I will share a little bit of the meta level of what was going on, right? Because when you hear about people's recruiting, when you hear about people's lives, especially professional lives, in a bio, everything seems so neat and perfect, right? It seems like it was so clear. And that was a really tough decision because I was on the path with the herd, right? Everyone, mostly everyone, did banking or consulting or some tech thing. And then after a couple of years, went back to grad school, largely business school for consultants. And so I was on that path, and that would have been a pretty good path. But Tom and Dick, the two professors who ran the engineering school, they were right. I did enjoy working with those high school students. And there was an electricity or a passion that was probably palpable that I didn't want to admit to myself because I was a little afraid of going off that path.
Right.
And so I sought the counsel of my core friends who thought this was an amazing opportunity for me. But my secondary and tertiary groups of friends, more acquaintances or people who kind of knew me, were extremely skeptical. They were worried that I would be returning to MIT as a staff person, not as a faculty. You know, I would be treated as a second or third class citizen. You know, I was taking a pay cut for when I was making in consulting. These were concerns of mine, but not real concerns, because I really had high respect for the deans of the engineering school. And I don't think they thought of the world as like first class and second class citizen. This was an important program to them, and they were awesome people. Who wants to take a pay cut? I didn't want to take a pay cut. I think they were right there. And it turned out none of those things, like these two concerns, weren't really concerns in the end, right? Like the key thing is I was really passionate. It was definitely a scarcer opportunity to go back to your alma mater, start this new program, work with these two professors who are deans of the engineering school, who had a bold vision for what they wanted to do for students. Who got to do that? Like, no one gets to do that. Whereas lots of people do consulting and then go on to business school. So I figured this passion is real and I'm going to do it. And it was probably the best decision I made in my career because it has defined and has been the path that has led me to where I am now. So grew that program from zero students to about 300, 275 students. We recruited volunteers. We helped students set up internships for the summer. We designed curriculum. I raised money. So essentially, I started my own mini business through this program and got to hire my own team. And through that, got to meet amazing people across the board, the faculty, the volunteers, the employers. And so one of the things we did was help students find an internship. And it was really hard to do that after 9/11, right? The US economy was kind of in shock. It was a bit paralyzed. And the last thing companies wanted to do was hire a 19-year-old, even though they may have been from MIT. You know, students still don't know how to do much. That's the whole point of internships, is getting the chance to learn and apply what, you know, you've learned in the classroom. So we set up phone banks. You know, I became a telemarketer, calling people, begging employers, begging MIT alumni, please take my sophomores. I'm serious. I've done more telemarketing and event planning than I'd like to remember over my life. But it was what was necessary to get done. And so we became very successful at placing students in internships. And while we were getting more comfortable with employers, we started off with contacting 50 employers and then eventually thousands of employers. And our first class with 73 students, we got to visit all these students at their companies. And the second class was 150 students. We got to visit all the students at those companies. So I started having this behind the curtain, behind the door view of how companies treated interns, new employees, how they thought about talent, the mindset, the thoughtfulness, the execution they put into it. At the same time, had this awesome opportunity to hear what students really said about companies. When you do a company presentation, students politely clap, but when you leave the room, I'm the guy standing there listening to what they're really saying about you, right? Right. And did they connect? Was it as good as you think it was? And so some employers started realizing that I had this access. So they started begging for insights. They started begging for kind of intelligence. Why weren't they winning? Who was winning? What did students really think? And so I was in a water park. I'm a huge fan of water parks. I was in New Braunfels, Texas, with a student of mine who I had met in that high school program that I was a TA in. And he worked in our office. And we're standing online for 3 hours on a water slide. And I start lamenting the fact that I was becoming a recruiting consultant. I was like, these employers are so curious about how to win. They want us to start writing a newsletter with best practices on how to recruit these students. And so I was like, I feel like I can write a book. Like, we visited all these companies, and my friend, now my co-author and business partner, said, well, why don't we write one? And I was like, I was joking. Like, I'm just lamenting, I'm venting. And he was like, no, let's write one. And I was like, okay. So we spent 3 years doing research. We interviewed over 400 students. We surveyed over 1,500 students across the US, understanding preferences, how people thought about careers and companies. And then essentially turned that 3 year research into a book called Recruit or Die, How Any Business Can Beat the Big Guys in the War for Young Talent. That was published in 2007 by Penguin Portfolio. And then through that, while writing the book, was meeting people by chance here and there, lots of people asking for recruiting advice. And so I met at a leadership development class, a guy who started at a startup and startup trading firm in Chicago. And he asked me for some recruiting support. He was tasked with recruiting. And so one thing led to another, and that led me to leaving MIT a second time to essentially start recruiting for this very secretive trading firm in Chicago circa 2008. And so I turned from a recruiting author and consultant, because although I wrote a book about recruiting, I didn't actually want to be a recruiter.
Right.
Because I met this company and they were very curious about some of the things we wrote about, that they wanted to hire me who had never really recruited before. And so they let me essentially, come in and run recruiting the way I wanted to, and largely practice the strategies that we had researched in our book, Recruit or Die. And I essentially turned into a mathlete recruiter, right? So you asked the question, how does one go from engineering at MIT to recruiting? I guess the type of recruiting we ended up doing was, the audience was so technical, the businesses were so competitive and so technical. I liken it to professional sports recruiting. And essentially, like, I got to handpick 15 people all over the world, similar to how Theo Epstein, who, by the way, I was living in Boston and Chicago. I left MIT to go to this company in Chicago that was secretive, handpicking mathletes all over the world. And who did I end up seeing on the plane on Mondays? Theo Epstein. who was also living in Boston, Chicago, who was making that transfer from the Boston Red Sox to the Chicago Cubs. And on one of those occasions, I sat next to him on the plane. And wow. It was hilarious because we were taking notes. Like he's talking about trips to the Dominican Republic, building these long-term relationships with these kids who are gifted ball players. And here I am on the phone, you know, talking about people in China and Australia and at Stanford and at Harvard and, you know, University of Illinois. And it was like, we almost did a double take. Like we're kind of doing a similar thing, but just for a different market. And, you know, it's high stakes. It's super competitive. You develop these long-term relationships. How do we, you know, how do you stand out relative? You know, he's got to stand out from the Yankees and all these other great ball clubs. Why would people choose the Cubs? We similarly, why would people come to our company? Except in our business, no one knew who we were, right? And so when I explained to my mom and dad and friends of ours, like what we do, I'm like, we kind of do mathlete recruiting. Think like athlete. And then I worked at this company for 4 years and then as a full timer. And then in 2012, decided to start my own company, largely centered around this mathlete recruiting. And that's a big part of what we do at the Blueprint Talent Group. We help companies understand the mathlete mindset. What does it take to recruit them? Both the strategy, the execution, the mindset, the organization. And so we help companies that want to recruit people at that level and then design the right internal and external approach to do it. So
Yeah, no, and it's an awesome answer. And, you know, it's kind of interesting because it's a very unique experience. Like you mentioned, you know, everyone has their set path in life that they have to go to business school, go intern, whatever, computer science, go intern at a big firm, and then maybe land a position, ride it out, and slowly climb up the ladder. But this one unique opportunity that came your way, and you know, you initially said, nah, but you thought about it and you went through with it. Could you ever have imagined at that time that your life would look like this if you said yes at that moment?
Never. I was so, I think FOMO existed. You know, I was 20, I was 23 once. Sometimes my team doesn't believe it, but I was 23. But I think FOMO existed less than it does now. We work with lots of young people, you know, coming out of undergrad, master's, PhD, and we hire a lot of people who work at Blueprint who are in this age group. And I see the stress that they're under. And I think it is far worse, the volume of stress, the type of stress, than what I ever thought about, right? Like, I never thought anyone was really judging me. I know I mentioned that second cohort, that second layer of friends or third layer of friends I call acquaintances. And, you know, they were telling me I was going to be a second, you know, class citizen and not do this job at MIT. I didn't think they were judging me. Hmm. When I counsel young people now, young people, 25, 19, 20, I really get the sense they are judging themselves very harshly and that they feel like they're being judged very harshly by their friends and family. And that worries me, right? That saddens me because life is an adventure, right? And if you're so concerned about being judged, or if you're in fact being judged, that limits your ability to really be in touch with your passion. You know, it shuts off that voice that tells you, is this really the right thing? Or, you know what? And if it isn't, it's going to be okay because I'm going to figure it out and I'm going to try again, right? Like that is the American way, right? Like, you know, you fail and you pick yourself back up and you learn from it. And there's no failure as long as you learn and you use it as an opportunity to learn, right? And so I do feel like some of that's gone because of this pressure young people put on themselves.
Absolutely. And I agree full heartedly with that statement. You know, Chris, I have a question. Where do you think this is coming from? Do you think it's increased this judgment that we have? Do you think it's from social media or what are your thoughts on this? Because, you know, you're in this field and you have a lot of individuals coming to you for advice on how to get a job, how to get people to come to our job. What are you thinking?
You know, two things come to mind. You said one of them, social media. I was a late adopter, right? I know for a lot of young people, you put up a picture, you're a guest at a wedding, you have this nice outfit on, and you see how many likes do I get. And there's some judgment, you know, instant gratification that comes from likes and loves. And I get it, right? I think that's a normal thing. And I think we're still figuring that out as a society. The other thing is a bit more controversial. You know, there's a saying, you know, my friends in their early 40s who are in our business say, we get older and they get younger.
Mm.
And I think it is awesome that the generation that graduates from college now is more connected to their parents in a way that we weren't, right? Like, I'm a late Gen Xer, and my parents provided me a lot of unconditional love and a lot of what I'll call infrastructural support. So for example, I was a science nerd. You know, I did international science fair in high school, which probably many people wouldn't even believe. like I did. And my mom and dad helped me build the board, right? Like, you have this like monstrosity, ugly looking science board. And my mom and dad, like, and I at midnight, but my mom and dad had nothing to do with the content that was on that board, right? They didn't help me decide where things go on the board. They just helped me build the physical board.
Right.
Whereas now, when I talk to people who've had a similar, you know, experience, maybe they did international science fair, maybe they do some academic games, I think parents play a much deeper role, right? Like, parents are providing, in some cases, day-to-day counsel, right? Mm. Like, you know, young adults, young employees will call mom and dad every day and say, oh, this is what happened at work today. And mom and dad are giving direct counsel, helping people shape their decisions. And I think on one hand, it's beautiful, right? It's like parents, you know, that is a way of delivering unconditional love. On the other hand, there's a cost, right? Everything in life has a trade-off. The cost is, I think it delays some of that independent thinking. And so the reason why I think this ties back to the pressure and the judgment is because it delays the point at which you have to stand up for your own decisions. And I think when you're in the nest, so to speak, you don't want to offend mom and dad. You don't want to offend big brother, big sister, aunt, uncle, and then all these friends you have on Facebook, because everything is known to all, you know, right away, right? So this is not me judging on where society is. It is me in my line of work observing and reporting back some of the things I'm seeing and acknowledging some of these trade-offs that I think contribute to what I believe is higher stress and pressure on these young people. So there's an irony there, right?
Yeah.
There's an irony that's in parents trying to protect their children in their 20s. You actually might be making it worse because they're not able to get the final finishes of becoming an adult. And so there's, you know, it is ironic, and there's no right or wrong answer, but, you know, it's just something I observe.
Absolutely. And I agree, you know, especially with a higher investment from parents, I could imagine that if something doesn't go right, since they spent so much effort and time, they might even feel a little bit inclined to say, hey, you know, maybe you're not going there, and keep putting on that extra pressure. Whereas if a parent just gave, you know, a little bit of support and they're like, okay, you know what, this person's done everything right by themselves, they already know what they're doing. And I'm not sure if this is even on a conscious level, but, you know, I completely agree with you. And that's kind of what we're seeing right now. And there was this one quote that I heard that I really liked. I'm not sure if you've heard this before, Chris, but it was, in success we celebrate, but in failure we reflect. And I think that's something that's not really talked about anymore. You know, on social media, everyone's posting their Lamborghinis in their garage, Ty Lopez kind of characters. And, you know, it seems like every other person's doing everything perfectly, but everyone who's done this has failed before, and they're not showing that aspect of it. And through those failures, we reflect on who we are. We reflect on what we like. We reflect on our goods, our bads, and how we can move forward. And I think that's something that's really missing right now. And I wish the conversation, that's what I try to hope this podcast kind of pushes through, that, you know, hey, you might think you're going this path, but you're actually meant for this path. Yeah. Do you have any comments on that? I was going to switch on to recruiting, but it seems like you have a comment, so I will zip my lips.
Yeah, no. I mean, sadly, you know, a lot of the world I live in that I love, the tech world, right? Like, you know, we're technology celebrating. You have all these awesome companies and founders who are engineers by training, which I also find awesome. You know, to go back to that, those deans, you know, Tom McNanty and Dick Yu, you know, developing engineers. It's tricky because you read about people's failures in this like tech world, and even the failures sound like successes while they're supposed to be failures. And it's like, and so even that gets neatly written and you put a little bow on it. And so on one hand, you want to acknowledge, yes, these people are being more open and transparent about a time they, you know, faltered and maybe their shortcomings, you know, came to be, so to speak. But I think it's really hard for young people. I'll never forget this, like speaking of my MIT experience, the person who taught me chemistry as a freshman, he had the courage to tell us he failed freshman chemistry when he was an MIT undergrad. And here he is teaching freshman chemistry, right? And that really resonated with me. And, you know, for a while, there's no way he thought he was getting into graduate school, never mind, you know, becoming a professor, right? And I feel like that's gone. I feel like the world is so competitive. And I know universities and grad schools say, we want someone who's dealt with failure. I'm not sure they really do. And I have friends who are deans of admissions. And, you know, if they hear this, they might come after me, or I might have to buy them an extra drink or something. I'm not sure they really want to know that you failed, right? Like, I think it's more like they want a cute story that I kind of failed, but I saw the light and everything was good at the end, right? And that's not real life, right? It's just a little too scripted, a little too Hollywood-esque, right? And I would love for people to get to a point, you know, where you can share real failure. And that's why they have the whole therapy business, right? This is probably the one place where people feel like they're not going to be judged, and they can share not just I failed, but here are the things going on in my head. And one of the positive things I compared to when I was 23 to now is that I do think that, you know, talking about mental health, talking about, you know, regular therapy checkups, right? Just like you go to the dentist, just like you go to a trainer, you and I are, you know, fitness rats, right? Like, it's just okay. It's just as okay to now have a regular checkup with someone who I could be completely open and honest with. I think that's great. I do wish some of that openness and transparency could be integrated into everyday conversations and interactions with each other. And we don't have to look all so damn perfect, you know, and all the time. Even when we're supposed to not look perfect, we have to twist it and package it such that we look perfect. So I know a long-winded way of saying it, but this is real life.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. And it's truly a shame. It's truly a shame. But, you know, like you mentioned, Chris, you know, the mental health conversation's coming forward. Who knows, maybe this failure conversation in life is going to come forward too in a couple of years. And, you know, it's something that's really important, in my opinion, and hopefully it does. But, you know, Chris, I wanted to kind of tap into a little bit of expertise you got from your years of running this program and, you know, your expertise in it. So I'd like to ask you, what are your top three tips for individuals who would like to get a job? And then after this, I'm going to ask you about for companies wanting to hire that top talent when they're the underdogs, when they're not Google, Amazon, or those big tech names.
Yeah, no, great question. So I probably have a more holistic view from both sides.
Sure.
I will try my best to get them into three distinct tips. For job seekers, the first thing is just trying to be very honest with yourself about where do you want to go and what's a next step. It doesn't have to be the next step, but it's got to be a next step for you, right? And so I think that being comfortable with not having the answer and being comfortable that the answer may not come to you right away is okay, but going through the exercise and seeking in yourself first, right? Like being in silence, thinking about my career, who am I? Where do I want to be? Also seeking the counsel of your friends, you know, your family, you know, various people who've engaged you, right? And let's face it, a lot of people are different versions of themselves, depending on who they're engaging. Who I am with my boss may be different than who I am with my employee or who I am with my, you know, religious person, you know, at church or temple or whatever, you know, versus, you know, colleagues of mine, right? And so you gotta kind of think, who am I, where do I want to be, where do I want to go? A lot of my tips honestly revolve around the tactical part, where you have to be nice to yourself, and in being nice to yourself, give yourself a runway. But nice to yourself means actually following through with your plan. So for example, I tell people, if you're looking for a job, you know, it's probably going to take 6 months to a year, and just own it. And think about this in phases. So phase one is the part where I was describing now. I want to be honest with myself. Phase two is, well, I've talked to my friends and family. I'm in exploration mode. So phase two is all about exploration. I'm willing to talk to anyone who's willing to talk to me, right? I have no criteria. I just want to get out there and I want to learn about people's past and experiences and industries and companies. And then I get a chance. And I find that for a lot of people, this in this exploration phase, they discover a little bit more about who they are in a more targeted way. You know, it's kind of like you start with a funnel and then you start going, okay, wait a minute. There's themes here that are emerging for me internally and externally, right? So the external themes may be, I want to do sports marketing, right? So the function I want is marketing, and the industry I want is sports, right? So I put those two together, like, or sports and engineering, right? And so after that, what I tell people is you want to have something you're dedicated to every week. So now I want to start executing, right? Like I want to start saying, okay, every week I'm going to designate at least 2 hours. I'm going to sit in this office, and until I do what I say I'm going to do, I'm not going to leave this office, right? So basically what I'm saying is you need a plan and you need to have discipline, right? And so, and if you miss an hour, again, rule one applies, be nice to yourself. But the people who succeed through transition are the people who they kind of like work through the ambiguity. They work through the pain, because looking for a job is very lonely and it's very, very isolated. You are isolated. You feel lonely. You are being judged by design, right? And so you need to push through it, and you need to make sure you recruit advisors and supporters who are going to cheerlead you, as well as give you practical advice, right? So if I go back to, you know, step one is like, figure out what you want to do, be nice. Step two is, okay, I want to do explore. Step three is I want to execute. I want to have a plan. And I tell people, if you could do something every day, do it. If not every day, every week. But it's got to be some timetable where you can hold yourself accountable and you know what the heck you're supposed to be doing. And when you feel like you're going to lose it because you're being judged or nothing's quite going your way, that's, you know, you could take a break and say, I'm gonna break away from this for a week or two. And then you recommit, right? Maybe you change part of your tactic. and you get feedback on you know, whether you do some introspection and you get feedback to yourself, or some of those people that you've been reaching out to, you're able to get real feedback. And then you iterate. The people who end up succeeding are the ones who push through the ambiguity, and they follow through with the plan. Even it's like the people who from a fitness perspective end up reaching their goals are the people who, when they feel horrible and they don't feel good and they're really tired and they don't want to work out, those are the people who still manage to go to the gym and they've got a workout, they've got a plan, it's on a list. And if they feel really horrible, they're the ones who phone a friend and say, I don't want to do my workout today, but I'm committed to doing this because I want to lose weight or I want to gain muscle. Can you come with me? They've got some way of holding themselves accountable, and they've got a plan B where they can have other people holding themselves accountable. But it's all about the plan and the follow through. And then if you fail, being nice to yourself and picking yourself back up and recommitting to your goal. So again, long-winded way, I mix a little bit of our common thread there of fitness. But life is similar no matter what. You want to lose weight or you want to gain muscle, you want to get a job. Both of those can feel very lonely. Both of those, you're being judged. You're either judging yourself or other people are judging you. But you got to push through it and surround yourself with people who are going to challenge you and support you. But the support part is even more important.
Absolutely. Amazing points. And I'd like to kind of reiterate, 2 out of 3 points that Chris mentioned were just to find yourself, just to explore who you are, find out what your passions are, and then you execute. Because it's, you know, like if you don't know what your strengths are, you're going to go down the execution path. It's going to take longer. It's going to be more lonely. And at the end of it, the goal is not even going to be worth it. That's such a critical point that I think a lot of people miss. So thank you so much for mentioning those, Chris. I'm wondering, what about from the recruiting side for companies that are new or they don't have those big names? Are there any tips that you have for them?
So for companies, believe it or not, it's kind of similar, right? I mean, a lot of companies don't know who they are, right? So I at Blueprint, we have a philosophy of, you know, good recruiting is about thinking about these things kind of in sequence, right? Like you need to know who you are, like your values as a company. Then, you know, what is my vision? What are the things I'm trying to achieve as a company? So there's values, which is the more personal piece, you know, the ethos. The vision is more about the company, the product that I'm trying to sell or service I'm trying to sell. And then what is the value proposition that's required to accomplish that vision that meets your values, right? So you got values, you got company vision and goals. Now I've got a value proposition that I've got to offer and then I've got to deliver to my employees and to myself. Then I could start thinking about what is the recruiting strategy and process required to support that value proposition, that supports that vision, that supports the ethos of who I am. But you know, it's exactly the same. Who am I? And then what am I as a company? What am I trying to achieve? What are my goals? What are my vision? What is the value proposition? What's the offering? You know, what's the work, the compensation, the culture, the leadership, and the career path? If I package those 5 things together, I call that value proposition. What is that needed in order to accomplish that vision? And then what's the recruiting strategy and recruiting execution and plan that supports that value proposition? Most companies go in reverse. They start thinking about the tactics of recruiting. Oh my God, like my marketing campaign, you know, I need this many views. What's my landing page? They think about it.
Metrics.
So then they end up failing because what we call this at Blueprint is they lack a product market fit, right? Yep. So just like I have a startup, I have a company. Yep. In the recruiting world, your product is your value proposition, this offering. Your market is your market, right? And so good companies that we support and haven't supported, good companies, you get successful in your business, right? And then people end up becoming more necessary. And you're like, I just want people, right? I just want people. Give me really good people. I have a really high bar. The problem is if you're an entrepreneur, you become very insular, right? Your venture capital firm has blessed you. They're very smart and they've given you a big check. I'm really smart. I've convinced my friends to be here. And so basically what happens is I'm smart. My friends are smart. We're here. You start losing connection to the market. You start losing the sense that there are other companies out there who also have smart founders, who also have interesting value propositions, right? And so you kind of end up, you know, believing your own dog food, right? Have you ever heard that saying, right? Like,
yeah,
you've drank your own Kool-Aid and you're unable to differentiate. And so you lose the ability to be empathetic with the talent because the talent is very confused and all these companies end up looking the same, right? And so as a result, then you end up just going towards those big brand names. And so you don't take the time to even look at smaller companies because you're just so confused, right? And so a way around all of this is, like, first things first, start with who you are and then finish with the recruiting strategy and tactics and then go from there.
Beautiful. Man, what a great world it would be if everyone just did both of this, the companies, the people. So much more happiness, I swear.
agreed. But there are no quick wins. There are no silver bullets in recruiting. There are none. Anyone who tells you otherwise, there could be times when a company is on a rocket ship, you know, Silicon Valley, like, you know, every founder will tell you they're on a rocket ship. We're going to the moon. We're going to Mars. We're going to Andromeda. you know, pick your, you know, destination, but it's way the heck out there. Yeah, there could be times where you've got so much momentum behind you. It's easier, you know, to get on that rocket ship. But if you want to deliver a value proposition where people are joining for the right reasons and they're authentic and they're going to stay for the right reasons, recruiting is about doing a lot of little things correctly. And humans don't scale the way technology scales or the way money scales. And so when we meet people, companies will say, well, I need to do XYZ in 8 weeks. I'm like, not possible. Not possible given what you've described. And no one wants to hear it, right? And so it's rare that we meet founders who go, you know, this is going to take a long time, because when you're dealing with people and culture, it's messy. People are messy. And that's not to say you don't want to be strategic and systematic. That's one of our goals at Blueprint, to help companies be both strategic and systematic in how they recruit. But you're dealing with humans. And so by design, it gets messy. And when you go into the human business, you just got to be ready that it's going to be messy. And you need to meet people where they're at.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Wholeheartedly agree. I'm going to switch the topics up a little bit. We're going to go from gear 5 to gear 6 as we're kind of going on to the closing segments. But what I wanted to ask you, Chris, is if you had an opportunity to talk to your 18-year-old self and give him the words of wisdom of where you are right now with your life, Chris, what would you say to 18-year-old Chris?
18-year-old me.
Big question. I dropped that on your freestyle.
I don't think about this that often, but I certainly work with a lot of 18-year-olds, you know, who are freshmen. You know, I think it's similar to a lot of things we've talked about on this podcast, right? Like, I don't know, you know, if you know Eckhart Tolle, you know, this like self-help. There's one story from one of the books I've read, and I did not read that as an 18-year-old. you know, I had the pleasure of becoming friends with a late astronaut. Her name is Janice Voss. She got her PhD at MIT. She was in space 5 times. She was a mission specialist.
Wow.
And that's a lot of times, right? So there are a lot of astronauts who've never been in space, right? I think they're called penguins. I think. Don't quote me, but I think they're penguins. You know, Janice and I got to be very close. She was a volunteer for us at UPOP. And And this Eckhart Tolle book, and having speaking to Janice about what's it like when the space shuttle leaves orbit and you get to look at the Earth. And so in Eckhart Tolle's book, he gives this example where the astronauts, when the shuttle leaves orbit and you look at the Earth is the most precious thing you could ever imagine, right? Like, there's nothing that you could ever imagine that's more precious than this thing. I mean, it's got colors and you see the clouds and you see land masses that you're familiar with, right? Like, you see the structures of our seven continents and you're just in awe, right? Like, some people may say this is like, you know, they've reached their, you know, like self-actualization, right? Like, and so what Eckhart Tolle says, you know, I believe is, you know, when you do something in life, you got to put everything into it. You want to put your all into it, right? And so it's almost like you're looking at this Earth, and so you want to put your all into it. But what he says, and what Janice Voss has confirmed to be true, is that when you're in space and you look at the Earth and you decide to look away from the Earth and you see nothing but black, endless universe of no lights, right? In some cases, depending on what direction you're looking, you realize the Earth is this insignificant dot in this like endless, infinite universe, right? And so what Eckhart Tolle says is that you want to live at that boundary. You want to live at that boundary where everything you do with the full most thoughtfulness and effort.
Wow.
But when it's done, regardless of what the outcome is, failure or success, it is just one speck in an infinite universe. And it's time to move on to the next thing. And if you can live life in that boundary, it is a place where you could appreciate the suffering that life will bring you, which is a part of life, but also the joy as well, right? And how you keep both in context and accepting your own humanity, right? So what I would tell my 18-year-old self is continue working hard like you have been, and put your all into it, but also don't take yourself in this too seriously, because there's going to be something else, right? And you're in it for the long haul. You don't want to burn out. Like, not one thing in and of itself doesn't define you at all. And it's okay to be human, which means, you know, you are not perfect by design, right? Like, you're not God, right? Like, you're human. And so, you know, and with that comes suffering and brokenness and joy and intelligence and awesomeness. And help others and help yourself, you know, go through this thing that we call life. And so I don't know if my 18-year-old self could have handled it, but he may have been like, this is a little weird. you got a little cosmic on me. But Janice Voss, a great, I call her a patriot, right? Like, astronaut. You know, she confirms that the Earth is exactly how Eckhart Tolle describes it, right? And how to live at that boundary is how I would advise my 18-year-old self to.
That was just beautiful. I was going to ask you another question after this, Chris, but I can't. I don't think there's any answer that could ever. That was just amazing. That was amazing, man. I got to be honest with you.
No, I think before, you know, you and I just met and we spoke for a while before this started. And I think I told you, you know, people told me when you hit 40, there's just something that happens and I roll my eyes. I'm like, yeah, whatever. Like, and there is something that happens for whatever reason, you know, for me, it was 40, maybe for others, it's 50 or 60 or 30 or 20. There's just something where you're like, how I view the world is very different. Hopefully in a healthy way. Like,
absolutely. Yeah. And, you know, I'm glad that some of the viewers that are listening to this are under that age and have this wisdom just tossed at them with that beautiful analogy. And I just really like that. I was going to ask you another question, Chris, but like, I'm telling you that I just, we have to quit it at the top. Like, we're at the moon and beyond. We have to go to another galaxy if we want a better answer than that one. So Chris, as we go on to the close, what are your shout outs for where individuals can find you? Where can people find your book? And how can people come in contact with the Blueprint Talent Group?
So I'll go in reverse order, I guess. If you go to our website, info@blueprinttalent.com, LinkedIn, we work for so many companies that are in some respects secretive, some are not, but many are. And so we have a bit of under the radar kind of ethos going on for ourselves. It's not because we're secretive people, but you can find many of us on LinkedIn and just connect with me there. And then book, Amazon, you can get hard copy, but more easily electronic copy of our book. So, and I guess this is what the hard copy looked like back in 2007.
Beautiful.
So Recruit or Die. Yeah.
Yeah. Awesome, Chris. And just before we go on to our official close, what is your one message for the audience? And this can be something that we talked about. This can be something that we didn't talk about that you'd like to talk about. And it can be anything. So it's very broad, just like that cosmic example we gave right before this.
So just repeat that part. So what one thing that...
Your one message to the audience. It can be anything. It can be motivational. It can be like, enjoy the sun. Anything at all. And that is very broad. And yeah, it's a deep question to finish off.
I think for me it's have fun and be have fun by living on these boundaries where, you know, you want to push yourself, but you want to be kind to yourself, right? Like, you want to work hard, but you also want to relax, right? Like, you want to, you know, there are times when you're going to be perfect and there are times when you're going to be far from it, right? And you have to be comfortable with that. And that's part of the human experience.
Beautiful. And I think with that, Chris, I just wanted to thank you so much for coming onto our platform, sharing your amazing story from going into the tech sector or the tech sector with MIT's civil engineering program, learning there, completely changing your path to recruiting, taking a chance on yourself and believing yourself and pursuing your excellence in your field. And, you know, I'm very glad to see the high level of achievement you have. And I know that the stories that you've shared on our platform are inspirational. The cosmic example, I'm telling you, I got to make that into our snippet. It was just so awesome. But yeah, thank you so much, Chris. I really appreciated having you on today.
Well, Parham, I want to thank you for having me. I had an awesome time. Look forward to staying connected with you. And we got to follow each other's workout regimens.
Absolutely. We got to post those Instagram stories. And to the viewers and listeners of the Personal Process Podcast, we hope you enjoyed this episode like I did, and we'll catch you on the next one. Hey, everyone. Parham back after another amazing episode with another amazing guest. We hope we added value into your life so you could take the tips from this episode and fuel your process forward. If you enjoyed our episode today and think other friends or family members may also appreciate the lessons that our podcast brings, be sure to share us with them. Subscribe and rate our show so we know how we did. And always remember, trust the process.